This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, December 27th, 2011.
I'm Jacqueline Froehlich.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madhokar.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And what we're doing today and all of this week between the holidays, going back and listening to some of our favorite stories from the past year. We did this last year. This year, we've been a daily show all year long. We've done 6 days a week.
Lots of stories to pick from.
Yes, lots of stories.
A lot of fun that was had.
Yes, a lot of fun was had.
I'm going to start with a story that I produce, but Antoinette, you're with me. It was part of our Route 66 series.
Oh, yes. Is it the Coleman Theater?
It's the Coleman Theater.
That was so much fun.
It was. And
that was our first stop, actually, of the day.
It was. Uh-huh. Right there on Main Street in
Miami, Oklahoma.
In Miami, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. The Coleman is a theater that was opened as a silent movie theater. Mm-hmm. And it had vaudeville. Tom Mix was there.
Yeah, and Will Rogers.
Will Rogers. Yeah. And this was one story. It was about an 11-minute story, but I could have made it 20.
Easily.
There are a lot of stories I didn't get to tell.
Easily. The tour guide that we had was fantastic. I mean, he went and took us to, like, every nook and cranny of that place and had a story for each room, each piece of furniture. He was great.
Former history teacher at Miami, Oklahoma High School.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here is our trip to Coleman Theater from the summer.
On Main Street in Miami, Oklahoma, a street literally stamped with Route 66 emblem, is the Coleman Theater. The venue opened to a packed house of 1,600 in April 1929. Although it never closed, it endured leaky roofs and partial decay. Now, it's a link between Miami, Oklahoma's past and future.
Right now, you're still standing in an 82-year-old building. Now, when we cross over this seam over here, you're going to be in a brand new building.
Glenn Redding is on the second floor of the Coleman Theater. On one side, a brand new ballroom that's bringing new activity to the town of 13,000. On the other is the Coleman itself, constructed under the guidance of George L. Coleman. Coleman and his brother moved to the Miami, Oklahoma area around 1900. Two 50-something bachelors trying to make a living digging water wells. Their lives changed when they discovered one of the world's largest lead and zinc deposits. Soon, they were making $1 million a month. Bachelorhood soon ended, and George Coleman and his wife began taking the train to San Francisco, Chicago, and New York to see the best vaudeville acts. But the Colemans tired of traveling far from home, and George wanted to sign top acts to come to him and his two small theaters he'd built in downtown Miami. That offer was turned down because those theaters were too small. Glenn Redding, tour guide and Coleman Theater historian, picks up the story.
So he contacted the Senior Orpheum Vaudeville Circuit out of New York City that had contracts for some of the biggest stars in America to be sent out to theaters. He offered them big money to come perform here, and they turned him down. They said, sorry, Mr. Coleman, the type of stars that we represent, we do not send to little rinky-dink theaters like the Glory Bee out in the middle of nowhere. These type of stars have to have a theater like we have here in New York City. He says, no problem, Uncle, build one.
He did. He signed Top Talent to perform 1 year later, and he contracted the Bowler Brothers of Kansas City to build his grand theater. They completed the job in just 130 days. It opened with 1,600 seats on April 29, 1929, with live acts and the silent film The Dummy, starring Frederick March and Zazu Pitts. The theater would host silent films and live acts for the next 10 years until George Coleman retired to Florida and leased it to an out-of-town company that began showing first-run sound movies. As radio and TV cut into the attendance, the Coleman sagged. The roof leaked, and on stormy nights, only seats under the balcony provided dry conditions.
If you came to the movies when it was raining, you had to sit under the balcony to stay dry or bring an umbrella. The balcony would catch the rainwater, ran over to a fire exit door and out like the downspout on your house.
Though it never closed, the theater eventually fell back into the hands of the Coleman family, and after careful negotiations, the family donated the space to the city of Miami. 22 years later, the Coleman is thriving.
Repaint and re-gold leaf the theater here because of the water damage. It had not been painted since 1929. Now, that took several years and several dollars to get that done.
Glenn Redding says the slow revival has been fueled by volunteers and without major corporate donors. And he says the work has been achieved with the help of what he terms miracles. Miracles like the woman who found a program from the first night among her mother's belongings, or the small sample of carpeting saved from ruin in an upstairs closet that allowed workers to recreate the exact design for the lobby floor. Then there's the original marquee, torn down in the 1950s. A plain folder marked Marquee discovered in a file cabinet offered some clues about that first Marquee.
And we found out that the Norman Corporation out of Nevada, Missouri had made and installed it, and they're still in business today after over 115 years. We call them and ask them, can you make us a Marquee like 1929? Because we know the numbers of the molds that you used. And they said, we threw those away 50 years ago. But our guys are good enough. You send us the original specifications and an old picture, we'll make one so close that most people will never know the difference. And we said we can live with that. About 2 weeks later, they called back and said, guess what we found in the old warehouse? We found the molds for the old Marquee. So our Marquee out in front is exactly like the one in 1929 because it came out of the same mold. Now, the most common word said up here at the top of the stairs is wow. And I've heard it in about 20 different languages this summer.
A short walk up the steps reveals not only a grand theater space, but another of the miracles Glenn Redding says keep coming. A 2,000-pound, 12.5-foot-tall, 10.5-foot-wide chandelier hangs over the balcony. The original was removed in 1963 for fear it might fall. Then it disappeared. Years later, an odd metal form was found under rotting hay in a horse barn formerly owned by the Coleman family. It was the base for the chandelier.
We get excited. We can get it replicated. We do a research and we find out that it had been cast in Italy. We said, what a break. Because somebody here had a brother in Italy. So we sent him on a mission. Find the foundry and find the molds. We get it recast. Well, he can't find a trace of it. He can't even find a little Italian that had ever heard of it. So we cannot restore it without the molds. It's gone forever. It'll never hang again. The best we can do is put an old picture of it in the lobby and show people what it used to look like.
Later, a group from Columbia, Missouri toured the Coleman. A woman in that delegation asked why a theater in Miami, Oklahoma, had a picture of the chandelier that was actually hanging in Columbia. She had some interesting information to share.
She says they not only built a theater like this for us, they made us a chandelier exactly like that. And those molds that you're looking for in Italy are not in Italy, they're in Columbia, Missouri. Would you like to borrow them?
The short answer, yes. Still later, in the midst of 6 tons of debris pulled from the attic, the original candlelights were found. But the most fantastic find was still to come. The original Wurlitzer organ that had accompanied so many silent movies had gone missing as well. For 12 years, the friends of the Coleman Theater pursued it. A series of connections led to a man in Burleson, Texas. He owned the original, and he offered for $100,000 to restore the organ and then install it inside the Coleman. A town of 13,000 needs some time to raise $100,000, and in the interim, another party offered 3 times as much to purchase the instrument. But the Texas owner kept his pledge and eventually spent 6 months installing the original pipes and all. And this organ, that's an actual recorded performance you're hearing, is no simple collection of pedals and keys. With certain levers switched off, it is a regulation pipe organ. With those levers activated, an entire orchestra is under command. Hit the right key, and an actual snare drum is struck in an unseen room, reverberating around the theater.
Up in that room up there is a real snare drum with 2 drumsticks. You hit the right key. If you know how to do them, we can get a drum roll, which I'm not really used to. If Tom Mix was fighting the Indians, then they needed the tom-tom. Or you needed a Chinese block.
Tom Mix was not only seen on the silver screen, he was one of many stars to get ready in the still-existing dressing room just off of the stage.
Now, this is the star's dressing room, the biggest star of the show, because it's the closest to the stage floor. The big star always got that dressing room. If you were the second biggest star, you took a flight of steps right up there. Third biggest star took another flight of steps. Fourth biggest star, another flight of steps. The lesser of a star, the farther you are from the dressing room. And as you found out, when you walk in here, you're standing in some famous footprints because you're standing exactly where Bob Hope and Bing Crosby were here many times. Harry Blackstone Sr., Tom Mix, some famous hoof prints out here. He rode his horse Tony out on the stage. Sally Rand the Fan Dancer, the little burlesque girl from the 20s. She performed here several times. But she always had to wear a flesh-colored bodysuit because there's a city ordinance against nude dancing in Miami. I think in other cities she needed a feather in the right place. Cary Grant was here. So was Doris Day. And that was before she was Doris Day. Will Rogers performed in here. Then people like the Three Stooges, Larry, Curly, and Moe.
Plus the Ziegfeld Follies and the Little Rascals. There are dozens of great stories associated with the Coleman. Oklahoma's own Will Rogers played there, despite plane problems that forced him to land in a farmer's field and not at the local Miami airport. Oh, and that farmer didn't have a car.
But he's got a tractor. So he puts Will Rogers on the tractor, drives him into the Coleman Theater. Well, they're still out at the airport. No phones. Finally give up, come in. They find him on the ground, across the street, down playing marbles with a bunch of little kids. They get him up, bring him in. He does his act, or he starts to do his act. Hollers, wait a minute, wait a minute. Jumps off the front stage, runs out the front door. He had forgotten his marbles. He went back out and got them from those kids. And sitting in the audience is this 15-year-old boy, Charles Banks Wilson, the artist. Makes some sketches. After it's over, he goes home and he paints a picture of Will Rogers.
That picture can be seen in the lobby. And a tour of the Coleman allows visitors to see other hidden spots, like the trapdoor Harry Blackstone used to make people disappear, or the original light switchboard that had a phone allowing stage managers to talk directly to the projectionist, or even George Coleman at his house. An amazing touch for 1929. And the Coleman still serves as a stage for entertainment, from Tulsa Light Opera to the Platters to a Sousa Night. The seats have been redone. Now the seating is 1,100. A new ballroom opened just this year, and it's bringing weddings, proms, and statewide conventions to downtown Miami.
That trip to the Coleman Theater, part of our Route 66 series that ran in the heat of summer.
Oh my gosh, it was so hot.
Yeah, it was.
It was so hot.
In 2011. Jacqueline Froelich. You did a story this year on, I don't want to say kids, but young people, undocumented young people in Northwest Arkansas and Western Arkansas.
Yeah, and what prompted me to do it is I read an article in the New York Times about the Obama administration wanting to ease up on chasing down undocumented immigrant youth. And I looked into it and found that it was this new regulation that was passed. And the Obama administration decided to overlook young people who are gainfully employed and had been here for a certain length of time, and to focus resources on criminal aliens to try, because money's short, right?
Mm-hmm.
Low on money all over the place. But I had been for years wanting to profile Jonathan Chavez, who's like the poster child of undocumented youth. So I got him into the studio, and we talked about his situation. He was brought here by his parents unwittingly. They have status. He still does not. He had been caught by an immigration officer in Florida, detained in jail for like a month. He made it back to the university, had lots of people advocating on his behalf. He did not know at the time of the interview whether he was going to be deported. His case was coming up. Turns out the federal immigration authorities have decided to close his case. Hmm. He's going to stay in the United States, pursue his master's degree in opera, hopefully set up a foundation. That's the great end of this story that wasn't in this story, and that he will likely be able to get a family visa and stay in the United States. Great, a great man, very generous and faithful man. It was an honor to interview him.
So now that we know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say, let's hear the story from earlier this year.
Most illegal immigrants cross into our country along remote, unguarded sections of southwestern U.S.-Mexican border. They pay exorbitant fees to unscrupulous human smugglers, some of them, called coyotes, to guide them here. The journey's fraught with danger. Getting mugged or killed by drug runners is common, and dying from exposure to extreme elements. But some arrive by plane, bus, or train on temporary visas, like Jonathan Chavez's family.
I came here from Peru when I was 14 years old. I actually found that I was coming like 16 hours before I came. Like, I came home and my mom told me, we're leaving tomorrow, pack your stuff.
He was told it was a trip to visit family living in America using a six-month tourist visa.
When we overstayed, I was wondering what was going on, and that's when my parents told me that we were staying here undocumented. So I really had no idea until like 7 months later. It was kind of a surprise. I wasn't expecting that at all.
Back home in Peru, his family had struggled to make ends meet after his father was injured in a car wreck. So they wanted to start fresh in America. But a year later, his parents divorced.
My dad lives in New Orleans with his wife and with my sister as well. And now my mom is in Fort Lauderdale with her husband, who are both U.S. citizens. My dad's wife and my mom's husband, they're both U.S. citizens.
And Jonathan, he's still undocumented. He settled in Rogers, graduated high school, then applied to the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, and was accepted without a Social Security number.
Yes, I was. That was kind of weird. I applied for it, and I just left that part blank. And I was just praying that God will do something about it. And I got accepted. So, and I had gotten a scholarship from the music department that pretty much paid for everything. So it was a huge blessing. It was really great. I wasn't expecting that at all.
Things were going really well for Jonathan, who's a music major, until he decided to take a trip to see his mom in Florida last winter. When he got off the bus in Fort Lauderdale, a Border Patrol officer asked him for his papers. When they discovered he had none, he was arrested by U.S. Customs and Immigration and detained for a month. Released on bond, he came home to Fayetteville to complete his university studies. He's very close to graduating. So the question is, will his deportation hearing, scheduled this November in Memphis, be dismissed because of the Obama administration's revised immigration policy to focus only on criminal aliens? Elizabeth Young is director of the University of Arkansas Law School Immigration Law Clinic. She says the policy is still too new.
So it's hard to say what's going to happen. I know there are a lot of cases that are pending that people have put forth, but we don't really know how it's going to be implemented yet.
But she is hearing a lot of criticism about the new policy, which some perceive as backdoor amnesty.
And it's not an amnesty. In criminal law, when you exercise prosecutorial discretion, you probably drop the charges or something along those lines. In immigration law, that's not what happens. They don't drop the charges as in just let them go, give them amnesty, they can stay here and have a status now. They still have no status. They're still, for the most part, on the radar screen. They will probably have to check in every once in a while, make sure that they keep their addresses updated. And then once the backlog in the immigration court systems gets caught up, they will be put into removal proceedings.
With regard to Jonathan Chavez's case, immigration officials in Memphis, our jurisdiction, have already started deportation proceedings against him, which Elizabeth Young says provides options. She and her immigration law clinic staff are assisting with this case.
Once you're in proceedings, you can apply for a host of different forms of relief that could potentially allow him to stay in the country. You know, both of his parents are here and have status, all of his family, actually, his siblings as well. So once he got put into proceedings, there are things that kind of got put into motion. And this prosecutorial discretion is hopefully something that will help individuals.
Because if his case is delayed, it could provide Jonathan Chavez more time to establish himself as a contributing citizen and accumulate even more character references. The outpouring of support for Jonathan during his detention in Florida, including from Chancellor David Gearhart at the University of Arkansas, he said, was overwhelming.
Thing in Florida when I was detained, like the chancellor was so great about it, like he even offered to go to my next court date or hearing if necessary. And the university was trying to get me to take classes through correspondence so I wouldn't lose my credit. So they were so amazing. I will be thankful forever for everything they tried to do in my behalf. And just like Dr. Gearhart and Dr. McMath and just everybody, met the chair of the music department, my teachers. Everything was Rhonda Mainz is her name, and my teachers were so great. I'm so thankful for them. I wasn't expecting that at all.
Jonathan Chavez is among an estimated 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the United States. Of those, more than three-quarters are Hispanic, one-fifth children under 18. In late September, nearly 3,000 undocumented immigrants were arrested around the country, all with criminal records, including 24 in Arkansas. That sweep was organized under the Federal 287G and Secure Communities programs that sanction local law enforcement to work with federal agents. But a recent federal study found too many non-criminal undocumented immigrants, including young people like Jonathan, continue to be targeted. Making matters worse are new laws in Arizona and Alabama, which allow authorities to question and detain people they suspect of being undocumented and to check immigrant status of students in public schools. Ana Aguayo with the Northwest Arkansas Workers Justice Center in Springdale assists undocumented young people and adults.
Many students who I've talked to are babysitting. They're not falsifying documents. They're not applying for an actual job. They're doing very low-skill jobs that can help them get just small cash at the moment. So I've heard from babysitting, other people are doing a little bit of consultant work if they know how to do website development. Let's say that's what they're doing on their own. Other people have taken actions to do print or photo shoots for people, and they just try to be as innovative as possible without breaking the law.
Aguayo says undocumented students in particular face the most challenge because educated in American schools, they simply seek to excel.
It's very difficult, I have to be honest. When you're looking at someone who was brought here at a young age without their own consent, and they were brought here because their parents had moved to this country. And as they grow up into our education system, they realize, I don't have the same access to college opportunities. Even though they're working hard, taking advanced placement courses, doing community service, trying to show good character, good moral character as a community participants, but their doors are shut.
Under the proposed federal DREAM Act, undocumented students would be allowed to pay in-state tuition, be provided work visas, and placed on a path towards citizenship. But the measure failed in December in Congress, leaving millions of undocumented students in limbo, a netherworld where they cannot legally work, drive a car, or seek educational financial aid. Margarita Solorsono is director of the Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas.
And that creates a lot of frustration, a lot of stress, a lot of depression sometimes, because these are sometimes 4.0 students or even above 4.0, and they cannot obtain scholarships. They cannot pay in-state tuition.
That's why her group provides scholarships to all immigrant students, no matter their status.
And we provide the opportunity. We give that incentive for them to continue being good students.
Like Jonathan Chavez, who turns out is a music scholar, a student of opera. He says if he's not deported, he'll graduate this spring, then pursue a master's degree at the Manhattan School of Music in New York City. And when he's finished there, he says he hopes to become a famous performer and philanthropist. He'll open up missions to help the poor. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Como Zagueu, eu quero subir o mais alto que eu puder, só pra te ver.
That story aired earlier this year on Ozarks at Large. That's what we're doing today and this week, listening to some of the stories that we enjoyed producing through 2011. Katie Henriksen, the newest member of the KUAF team.
And this was like this, maybe the second or third story that I did. And it's about Dusty Higgins, who is a comic artist and graphic novel artist. I mean, he had a writer who wrote the story along with him. So he was the one who illustrated the book. But he had a teen author event at the Fayetteville Public Library. And he came in and talked to me about this graphic novel, which is Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. And it was a very good Halloween theme. The story ran on Halloween. But we ended up talking about, he went through the University of Arkansas Journalism Department, and he kind of told the story about how he even got into drawing comics professionally in the first place, which I thought was really interesting. And we started talking about all sorts of things from Halloween to drawing graphic novel, what the publishing industry is doing now. There were so many things that we ended up talking about.
And many people see Dusty's drawings every week in the Democrat Gazette because when there's an Arkansas Razorback football game, you know, there's this cartoon that's on the sports page that mm-hmm. shows like the Razorback taking on the Tiger from Auburn. That's Dusty's work as well.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah. I did not know that.
He's very versatile.
Yes.
But he was great to talk to, and that's what I love. I just love having conversations with people because they can lead in so many different directions. You just sit down with someone and you start on topic of from why you brought them in, and then one thing leads to another, and you find out all mm-hmm. the stories.
Well, let's listen to Dusty. This is from a Halloween broadcast of this year.
Keeping up with the Halloween ghoulish theme today, I spoke to Dusty Higgins Saturday afternoon before he gave a talk at the Fayetteville Public Library about his graphic novel series called Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. I spoke to Dusty Higgins about the series, about being a comic artist in Arkansas, and also about his love of zombies. Like, tell me a little bit about your background as someone who draws comics. You've actually drawn a lot of other kinds of comics besides graphic novels. You do stuff with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. So tell us about that and then about the transition and how it's different when you create graphic novels.
Okay. I've got a funny story that involves the University of Arkansas, because when I was in high school, I drew comics for the high school paper, just like little comic strip type of comics. And when I was coming up to the University of Arkansas for my freshman orientation, I happened to stop by the journalism department. Patsy Watkins was one of the journalism teachers there, and she was kind of there when we were touring the department. And I was just talking about how I did cartoons and happened to have some on me and kind of showed it to her. And she said, well, you know, we'll pay you to put this stuff in the Arkansas Traveler. Like, you'll actually get paid. And that just kind of sent lights off in my head. And I thought, wow, you know, I can actually get paid to do this thing that I enjoy. And so going through the art department at the University of Arkansas and later the journalism department, I ended up getting a job at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, where I didn't do comic strip illustrations, but I did more feature illustrations just to illustrate newspaper stories and that sort of thing. And so when I started doing graphic novels, it was more like coming back to something that I originated with. You know, it's not a lot different to sit there and illustrate a sequential story like you do in a graphic novel. I'm always illustrating a story. I'm always telling a story through the art. So doing that in sequential form like you do in a graphic novel is not a big step from what I do day to day.
You have actually two out already of the Pinocchio series, and you're having a third release. Tell us about this story a little bit.
Okay, well, if you go back, I think a lot of people are more familiar with the Disney version of Pinocchio.
Right, that's what I'm
which is a lot
with.
Different from the original story, which was written by this guy named Carlo Collodi back in the 1800s. One of the key differences, and something that we really focus on in the book that actually inspired us to go a little bit further than we did beyond the first book, is the book starts out saying, once upon a time, there was a piece of wood. So in the original story, the wood was already alive. Like, there was no fairy that came down and sort of made this puppet come to life. The wood was alive at the beginning, and Geppetto just happened to carve it into a puppet. So that allowed us to sort of explore, here you have this puppet, and when his nose grows out, you know, it becomes this sort of wooden stake that he can use to kill vampires. Like, maybe there's something a little more to the history of that. Like, where did this living piece of wood come from? And that's something we sort of explore throughout the book. Like, in addition to, you know, Pinocchio slaying vampires and, you know, the funny situations that arise with that. Like, there's this sort of deeper story of where did Pinocchio come from and why is he sort of this ultimate vampire slaying puppet. I'm a big fan of myths and origin myths, and that's another thing we sort of did with the vampire book or with Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, is we went back to the origin myth of vampires, and it's not the Bram, it's not the Bram Stoker vampire, you know, that everybody's familiar with. Like, vampires were initially, like, they were bloated corpses that sat in the ground, and when people walked by, they would pop up and, like, fill up with blood, and it was more related to, like, the sun god, and, like, the darkness was, you know, the antithesis of the sun god were these vampires that lived in the darkness kind of deal, and that monster still existed, but it was a much different form. It wasn't the twilight vampires where they sparkle in the sunlight and everything's kind of like, oh, you know, these are nice vampires, you know. they were still monsters, you know, back then, and we wanted to portray them as like, vampires are not your friends, you know, they're not going to be nice to you.
Although the graphic novel series is about vampires, Dusty actually prefers zombies, and I asked him why.
So
why zombies then? Why do you actually have more of a thing for zombies?
You know, I'm not really sure. I think it's because zombies reflect us in many ways, sort of going through the motion. A zombie just, he goes through the motion. And like the way our culture has kind of become, in a sense, zombified. You know, we go to work every day. We sit at a cubicle. We just go through the motions. And in a sense, we are sort of symbolically zombies right now, except we don't eat each other, which that's a pretty big difference. But I think that's what I like about it, is that in a lot of ways, if you're not living life, you're sort of a zombie.
Are you doing anything for Halloween? Are you going to dress up?
I actually am going to dress up. I have a daughter who's a year and a half right now, and it just so happened we were at our local library a few weeks ago, and they had costumes to check out, which I thought was really cool, and my wife was really excited about that because we didn't really want to spend the money on like a costume that she's going to wear once. But the only costumes they really had were a Bumblebee costume and Star Wars costumes. So my daughter is going to go as Chewbacca for Halloween, and I decided, well, if she's going as Chewbacca, I have to go as Han Solo.
There you go.
My wife has to go as Princess Leia.
There you go.
That's just the way it works out. So.
And so tell the listeners, if they want to check out your work or your books, tell us where people can find them and where they can go to find more stuff that you do.
Well, obviously you can find them at the library. any retailer, if they don't have the book, like, you know, you can get it from Barnes & Noble. They may not have it in the store, but they can definitely order it for you, you know. Or Amazon is a good place to pick up the book. You can always go to my publisher's website, slgcomics.com. And they, of course, have plenty of books that they'd be more than happy to sell to you.
For Ozarks at Large, this is Katie Henriksen.
Dusty Higgins on Ozarks at Large. That first aired on Halloween Day, which I think was a Monday this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Katie, do you like talking to people, whether it's in front of a microphone or not?
I love talking to people, but I'm adjusting to getting them comfortable with the mic because I'm used to talking to people and doing a lot of print features, mm-hmm. and having a little tiny digital recorder, but this is different with the mic, big mic right in front of them.
It can be somewhat intimidating,
yes.
Can't it? Yes. If you talk to someone this year, and I remember when you were done with this conversation, you have certain interviews where you just feel good about the interview because mm-hmm. the interview subject just could talk about what they were passionate about, and Dr. Sam Totten was one of those conversations.
That is true. Dr. Sam Totten is a genocide scholar at the University of Arkansas, and I think he came in during the summer. He had been working on his book on Darfur, his book on this genocide that is happening behind the scenes in Nuba Mountains in Sudan. He had been working and interviewing, you know, these people being affected by these genocide like incidents had just come out, and he came to the studio and he was really interested in talking about just the genocide. He wasn't interested in talking about his book. He thought that this cause was more important, and it was really interesting, and I would like to mention that, you know, he said that if we want to make a difference, you know, as people in Arkansas, we never realize how we can make a difference. He said that we need to call up our representatives in the state on a national level and let them know that we care about this and they should take an action against something so heinous as this.
So here is your conversation with Dr. Totten from this summer.
Now,
You're a genocide expert.
Yes.
So how does a genocide begin? What are the early warning signs of a genocide?
That's a great question. All genocides are different, of course. The antecedents are different. It's contingent, obviously, upon the culture, the groups involved, the history of the groups involved, the impact of colonialism and possibly not the impact of colonialism. It just depends on what the situation is in that particular region. But to answer your question in a general sense, certainly early warning signs, when people are ostracized for who they are, not what they've done, but ostracized for who they are, people who are subjected to prejudice and discrimination, isolation within their own country. Also, when there are roundups of individuals, groups of individuals. And remember, genocide is, while the individual suffers, genocide is targeted at a particular group of people. Under the UN Convention, the groups are national, racial, religious. So when groups start to be targeted, whether it's people are excluded from schooling, mm-hmm. excluded from civil society, are arrested and detained, as I said, are deported. If there are refugee flows, that's an early warning signal. If there are killings, crimes against humanity, massacres, sporadic massacres, all of those can be an early warning signal. Now, if those early warning signals mm-hmm. are addressed and stopped, one doesn't know if they would have ever morphed into genocide or not. You only know genocide when genocide is taking place. But where the international community makes a grave error is that they don't address those early warning signals. If we see crimes against humanity being perpetrated, that is the time to act to prevent genocide.
Many people believe that the situation in Darfur is over, the genocide is over, but there is a current situation brewing in Sudan. Could you tell us something about
on the Darfur genocide? Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I'm glad you asked that question because the situation in Darfur, at least as far as the international recognition of that crisis, has been going on since 2003, and it's not over yet. There are attacks going on to this day. The mm-hmm. government of Sudan, in fact, recently attacked a number of villages with airplanes and ground troops, and that resulted in, again, refugee flows away from those villages into IDP camps or internally displaced persons camp. There are approximately 2 million people who are internally displaced to this day in Sudan, 2 million people.
Now, in Darfur, the Arab-backed militia and the, would it be correct to say, a government-backed group attacked black
Africans?
Yes,
without a doubt.
So it was racial. The attacks were racially motivated.
Yes. Now, there have been debates over that among scholars and others. If you look at the people, they look the same. They're all black, mm-hmm. whether they're Arab or black Africans. Mm-hmm. They speak the same language. They're all Muslim. Mm-hmm. They live together. They live next door together. They engage in commerce.
Being black or Arab does not have to do anything with skin color. It is, would you call it a background thing?
In Sudan, it's a very complicated situation. Groups are perceived as being black or Arab simply because of, yeah, the culture that they have, where supposedly the links that they came from over the years. If they're nomadic, they're mm-hmm. generally perceived as Arab. If they're sedentary, they're generally perceived as black. As I've pointed out time and time again, when the Government of Sudan troops, or GOS as I refer to them for Government of Sudan, and the Janjaweed, the Arab militia, when they attack and when they have attacked over the past 8 years, when they come in, the Janjaweed on horseback and camels, 300, 400, 500 strong from different ends of the village. Mm-hmm. When they come in and they scream and yell, and when the GOS comes in on their vehicles, they actually call the people black. When the girls and the women are raped, the Arabs say to them sometimes, "We are creating tomatoes," meaning they are creating babies that are going to be red, even though in fact they'll end up black.
In 2005, a comprehensive peace agreement was signed by the government of Sudan and rebel forces from southern Sudan to bring an end to a 22-year-long civil war. It also set a deadline by which southern Sudan would have a direct vote on its independence. However, the oil-rich state of South Kordofan that lies between Sudan and South Sudan was left out of the peace agreement. In January, people from the southern part of Sudan voted to form the independent sovereign nation of South Sudan on July 9th. However, since the state of South Kordofan was left out of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, it faces an uncertain future. The area includes Nuba Mountains, which are occupied primarily by Sudanese who identify themselves as Black Africans and live in a tolerant society comprising Muslims, Christians, and animists. Tension has escalated between Sudan and South Sudan in regard to the latter gaining independence on July 9th. The conflict has bled into South Kordofan, especially into the Nuba Mountain region. Reportedly, atrocities are being committed on the people by government-backed forces and Arab militia called Janjaweed to maintain a tight control over the state's oil resources and use it as a potential negotiating chip in the ongoing determination of borders.
What we do know, though, is the violence has been carried out day in and day out. And you know, I've been sending you the reports that I've been receiving from an unnamed source in the Nuba mm-hmm. Mountains and the photographs of the people who have suffered horribly.
Mm-hmm, they have, and the photos are very disturbing, although we don't get to see them on regular media. Does it frustrate you when you see a lot of so-called celebrities on TV being covered or being given airtime instead of such horrific crimes being committed against humanity?
Yeah, so I assume that you're not talking about the George Clooney's who get on and talk about these issues, right? You're not talking about them or the Mia Farrow's who are trying to draw attention.
No, I meant more like the Kardashians.
Who are the Kardashians? Oh, okay, I do know, yes. Well, you always have to try to maintain a little humor because this stuff it could kill your spirits, but it's actually more than frustrating, but probably what is even more depressing is that almost every single presidential candidate over the past, decade at least, especially after what Bill Clinton did in his administration by totally ignoring the genocide in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And that was horrific in the sense that in 100 days, between 500,000 and 1 million people were killed. And so as he told his administration, don't use the G word, genocide, otherwise we might be expected to go to Rwanda. Almost every single presidential candidate, including Barack Obama, said that, well, if we were president, we'd do this, mm-hmm. and this when a genocide mm-hmm. appeared. And yet, the other night, he got on the radio, he spoke for 2 minutes about the Nuba Mountains, and then he went to a fundraiser in New York, and I think he was there for 4 or 5 hours. So it's pushing Congress and pushing the executive branch to do something about this genocide. And I don't mean go over and fight al-Bashir. I don't see that happening. Certainly not in light of the fact that we're in Afghanistan and in Iraq and, you know, supporting the situation in Libya, but pushing the United Nations to do something. There is a United Nations mission in the Nuba Mountains in South Kordofan, but they've been accused of a few dastardly acts. And mm-hmm. so people in South Kordofan in the Nuba Mountains now are speculating that at least some of these UN personnel, soldiers, are being paid by al-Bashir to support al-Bashir's moves in South Kordofan. Now, recently, through the good efforts of Canada, along with the United Nations, there is something called the Responsibility to Protect. And the whole idea there is if a individual nation, let's say Sudan, neglects to protect its own people, then the international community has the right to step in, and nobody can say, well, this is internal affairs, we're a sovereign state. Well, they can say that, and al-Bashir has said that. But the whole concept or the whole idea behind the concept of responsibility to protect is, hey, we're all humans. We're all part of the global community and international community. And so individual nations do have the responsibility to go in and protect those who cannot protect themselves.
But it is a very powerful argument. How do you differentiate between interfering in a sovereign state's domestic affairs and intervening in a situation such as this one?
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem. It's part of the problem, certainly, when a nation enters a country without the backing of the UN Security Council. Then there are all sorts of questions that arise. Why did that particular nation go in? Well, they could say that they went in for human rights, and yet they may have gone in for the oil. We know about that situation, unfortunately, and those accusations. That's where the United Nations needs to come in, and that's what these missions are about. If they would support strong missions, that you go in, you protect the people. If you need to help rebuild the society, you do that. You stabilize and you get out. And it's a effort that is hand in hand with the people, with the acknowledgement that this is the people's country. They're going to run it, and nobody's going to stay there and take the resources, and they're not going to become, meaning the outsiders, neo-colonialist.
That conversation with Dr. Sam Totten from this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ethy. Antoinette.
Yes.
Second day in a row, we're going to hear a story that you're responsible for that doesn't have your voice in it. What's
Stephen,
going on here?
What's wrong with that? I mean, the story should be more about the people anyways. I mean, I don't use a lot of my voice to begin with, so. The Botanical Garden of the Ozarks opened a butterfly house. Is that the house is what we...
Sure.
Right? Earlier this year, I think late summer, early fall. And the reason I picked out the story was because it was kind of what we call like a sound story, where you sort of just get to make this montage of all the sounds that were happening, you know, from the people talking to the sounds of people just observing. And it's kind of cool because... you're kind of like a fly on the wall as you just, you kind of basically stand there.
Or a
butterfly on the wall,
yes.
And you kind of just stand around with your mic. And what's really fun, I mean, you do interviews while you're there. But what was really fun was when you get back to the studio and you hear these little things that you didn't realize the mic picked up while you were there. You know, little children being really excited about a particular color of butterfly or things like that. And so that was just a lot of fun for me being able to put that together.
Isn't this great?
Yes, it is.
This is very, very interesting.
We have a butterfly garden that we are opening. Included in the butterfly garden is the butterfly house and butterfly pavilion. And we're excited about certainly having the butterfly house. It gives us an opportunity to showcase the butterflies. It's exciting. But the Butterfly Pavilion gives us a place where students or groups can meet and be out of the weather. So it's exciting to have that also. David McKee designed and built. And if you will note, it looks like a butterfly, does it not? I'm excited because we have a lot of opportunity for a lot of guests, new guests to come to the garden, and I'm excited to move on to the next project.
Can't see the one with the worms.
Oh, look, there's a cocoon. Look at the cocoons.
You're welcome.
It went from green to blackish, so I think he's going to come out by tomorrow. And then these are empty black swallowtail chrysalises, but there's some right up here that haven't come out yet.
How many different species do you have in here?
Well,
I'm count. Well, there's Black Admiral, or Red Admiral. I see Buckeyes, Monarchs, but they don't really want the Monarchs to stay in here because they migrate. Of all the butterflies, they will migrate. Yeah. Well, they want them, but by keeping them in here, then it keeps them from migrating.
Abigail, we gotta go.
I just walked in. Look at you. You make it very pretty.
Yes, you did a nice job.
One of my other names is the Butterfly Lady. So probably 8 years ago, we started teaching children about butterflies and the importance of having the host plants, because we are destroying host plants and the numbers of butterflies are diminishing tremendously. So we've been working to get that message out, and this butterfly pavilion will help us to do that. Our ultimate goal is, we're kind of late in the season, so we have a lot of butterflies, but we hope to have even more in the spring. But the pavilion has host plants, so each butterfly lays eggs on only one or two types of plants. So by putting host plants in here, the children and adults, because adults don't know this either, can come and see the whole metamorphosis.
That story first aired earlier this year. What we're doing today and what we'll do Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday this week on Ozarks at Large, all of us that work on the show, or most of us that work on the show, talking about our favorite shows. Christina Thomas, we didn't hear a story from you today.
No, we didn't.
So I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Because you're relatively new at
Pretty,
this. I mean,
yeah,
you've been
relatively.
Doing it a year and a half. And I ask you this because I know that I still, after 20-plus years of doing this, feel odd sometimes when I put the headphones on in a public place and I have the what we call a shotgun microphone,
right,
and I'm standing in the middle. You're very conspicuous. I'm wondering, someone who's relatively new at that, does that ever make you feel conspicuous?
It's better now than it was than it was in the beginning. But yes, you definitely stand out, I would say. I went to an event actually at Drake Field, and there were all these other reporters there, you know, but the TV reporters, you know, had their cameramen.
Right.
But, you know, I definitely stood out with headphones and a long microphone, for sure. I felt different.
Anybody else here? Do you still feel conspicuous?
Oh, all the time. I am constantly looking for ways to sort of hide things. Like, you have the bigger headphones. I've got the really tiny, like, iPod one, so that's kind of conspicuous. And I usually kind of have a bag that I can put my equipment in, so all that I have to worry about is the microphone.
So you kind of look like a hipster. You have those white headphones and a cool bag.
Well, no, mine are black ones.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Different.
Microphone's kind of hard to hide, though. It's pretty big.
I know. Well, I'm shorter anyways, so I think if I sort of hold it down lower instead of like not right in someone's face, because they're good mics and they pick up really well. I think people feel a little more at ease because you want your interview subject to feel at ease to talk to you.
Katie, do you ever?
I did one story with Antoinette where we went out, and then I did an improved lighting reading highlights. But what I noticed is when I was listening to the reading, it was kind of better. I could actually concentrate more on the subject at hand. If I wasn't wearing the headphones, I usually end up wandering. My thoughts wander during a reading, but this time it was like I had my own private listening room for the story.
You become very insular. Yeah. Jackie, do you feel
what
feel when you if you're out public with the headphones and a microphone? Do you feel conspicuous?
Well, I'm not in my body. I've become a human recording device, and so I tend to just watch everything around me. Adults tend to avoid me. Children gravitate to the microphone and call out, you know, what's that? What are you doing? What's going on?
Or they just come and tap at it.
Yes, that happens a lot.
Notice it in a public school, yeah.
Do you feel conspicuous, I think?
I tune everyone out.
Okay.
Once the headphones are on, everyone's out.
And I've seen her. I've gone on stories with you, and she's just in the zone.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Well, more stories that we liked tomorrow on Ozarks at Large. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.